All lines are now bridged.
Great. Thank you very much. And good morning, everybody, and welcome to the USCDI Task Force. We appreciate you joining us today. I'm Mike Berry. I'm with ONC. And I'd like to open up today's meeting with roll call. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Leslie Kelly Hall.
Hey, everybody.
Ricky Bloomfield.
Good morning.
Hans Butzendijk. Grace Cordovano.
Good morning.
Jim Jurgis. Ken Kawamoto.
Morning.
John Kilbourne.
Good morning.
Leslie Leonard. Clem McDonald. Aaron Meary.
Good morning.
Brett Oliver.
Good morning.
Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Michelle Schreiber.
Good morning.
Abby Sears.
Good morning.
Sasha Termott.
Good morning.
Andy Truscott. Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Dan Breeman.
Good morning.
And Denise Webb. Great. Thank you, everybody. And I'll now turn it over to our co-chairs, Stephen and Leslie.
Thank you so much, Mike. And thank you, everyone, for your attention this morning. We can tell you that all of our past meeting notes are now posted to the web. We even got last week's in time before today's meeting. So we're finally on a roll now that we're going to be finishing up our work. We are going to have some ONC folks, specifically Mike Lipinski here from the team, to talk to us a little bit about the policy behind our work and to answer some key questions that especially Mark and others raised last week. We'll then come back to our work on tasks 2B and C. I'm guessing we're not going to get all the way through our work today, given that we have a chance to talk to Mike and others. So I'm guessing we're going to end up needing one more meeting to finish up our recommendations on 2B and C before we're going to be able to prep those for a presentation to USCDI. We'll do our public comment as usual, 5 minutes before the end, and wrap it up there. So with that, let's go on to slide 4. And Mike, I'm not sure everybody here knows you, so maybe you can just introduce yourself a little bit and your role on the team at ONC, and then go through your couple of slides, and we'll do some Q&A.
Okay. Can everyone hear me clearly? Just want to make sure.
Yes.
Okay. Michael Lipinski, attorney by trade, I guess. I've been with ONC since 2009, so passage of the Recovery Act and the High Tech Act, and been working on regulatory and policy matters with ONC. Since that time, now I'm director of the Regulatory and Policy Affairs Division, as you see on your screen, which is one of three divisions within the Office of Policy, and we have like three branches that focus on regulations, focus on info blocking, particularly both guidance and any compliance issues under the program in coordination with OIG. And then another branch that focuses on really like federal policy, so working with our stakeholders, primarily CMS, and leveraging the use of health IT. So today I think I'm going to focus on talking to you about how the relationship, I think, with USCDI and EHI under information blocking. Thanks for having me.
Great. Any questions for Mike before he jumps in? All right, why don't you go ahead then?
Okay, so on your screen, obviously, is the definition of information blocking. That's in 45 part 171.103. The key piece is what you see highlighted, which is in red font. So what we did is, considering, you know, all the comments that we received on the rule, which were over 2,000 submissions, and concerns both about the proposed DHI definition itself, and then just the market and actors that were covered under the rule in terms of compliance and understanding the rule. We took a few steps. I'm not going to talk about the content and manner exception today, but there is some relationship there in terms of giving, for lack of a better term, a glide path for stakeholders to comply with the regulation. So the other thing we did, though, is what we are going to talk about, which is for that period of time that you see, so since April 5th through October 6th, which is about 18 months exactly, we limited the data that had to be exchanged for purposes of compliance. And so the easiest way for us to do that was to identify a set of data that the market or actors were familiar with. And granted, not all are familiar with the USCDI because how broad the definition of actor is particularly healthcare provider definition. So you're talking, you know, labs, post-acute care, skilled nursing facilities, probably have not, you know, used certified health IT or have any reason to pay attention maybe to some of this regarding standardization of data. But anyhow, we felt it was the obvious set of data that, you know, based on the proposed rule and what a majority of stakeholders were familiar with. So that's why we used USCDI as our basis. But the key part, and we've issued a few FAQs on this that I think folks are, you know, that aren't as close to this miss, and it's understandable, is that it's just the data that's represented by the USCDI, so it has nothing to do with the standardization of the data. It's just that, you know, it doesn't even, you know, if it's EHI, it doesn't, and you have that data, it doesn't have to be in the format identified by the USCDI standard, or it can be in a different standard. So, like, a really obvious one always is, like, problems. Sometimes it can be coded in, you know, the ICD-10, for example, comparative to SNOMED CT, and that's fine in terms of it still meets the definition and needs to be made available for any legally permissible access, exchange, or use. So I want to stop there just because I think that's the first key part before we talk about the broader definition, so to speak, of EHI. And I think one other thing we talked about in the rule was, you know, this is the definition of EHI. I think we said something like at this time, because there's certain data that, and we could talk about how the designated record set works too, but there's certain data that we didn't focus on. You know, we obviously took comment on pricing information, right? And we didn't specifically include that. However, if it is in, you know, in the designated record set, once we get past October 6th, then that would be data that, or to October 6th, not past, to it. That would be data that would have to be made available. But I'll stop there before we talk. I don't know if I should stop there, or do you want me to, it's only one more slide, so we can go through the broader definition. Maybe that helps from context, and then we can talk, if that makes sense. So, yeah, let's just move to the next slide then. I think that's probably, okay. So here is the actual full definition of EHI that we codified in regulation, and that's in 45 CFR 171.102. This was, again, you know, based on comments that we received, alignment for a lot of stakeholders who are familiar with EPHI and concerns about having to have two different sets of data that they would have to keep and differentiate between for compliance with two different rules. So hearing that comment, we focused on essentially EPHI that would, to the extent that it would be included in the designated record set. And there obviously is a definition of the designated record set, and there is guidance on OCR's website about the designated record set. There's a key pieces are that, you know, if it's used, essentially, to make decisions about individuals, but there's also other data that's specifically identified that must be, like, enrollment, payment, medical records, billing. You know, there's a definition of what a record is. I don't want to get too deep into that, but unless we can get there if we want to. But I think a key part, because we get a lot of questions about notes, and we're continuing to issue guidance about, you know, the 8 notes that are identified in the USCDI. But the key piece, you know, to keep in mind always from a context perspective and guardrails is that if it's used to make decisions about individuals, those notes, then it needs to be part of the designated record set, and then therefore will be EHI. Okay, I think I've said what I need to. I think really it'll be formed now by your questions, so we can go there.
Thank you so much, Mike. Really appreciate your making the time to join us and go through this. I actually know that our questions go off in a slightly different direction. So I think starting with the one thing that has really come up here is the whole question of the role of USCDI future versions with regard to information blocking. And I think it's been clear, you know, and Al, who's now with us, has reiterated that as we make the transition in 2022, next year, to the requirement to support the access, exchange, and use of all EHI, that USCDI version 1, you know, sort of fades into the background with regard to information blocking. But as far as we've heard, there are no specific plans for information blocking in particular to point to any future versions of USCDI. But the thought has been raised, and we've discussed a couple times here, that the industry really has yet to fully embrace any specificity around how we're going to provide access, exchange, and use of all EHI. You know, what are the technical standards? What, you know, what is the format? And of course, as you intimated, you know, a clear definition of what belongs in the designated record set or not is going to be part of that determination. And you know, we're really talking about, you know, less than 2 years away, where providers are going to be held to this, and yet the vendors, you know, aren't required to have EHI export capability until the end of 2023. So there is this long period where providers are held to something that isn't well defined. Vendors are not yet required to support that, and I think there's some confusion. So one thought that has been suggested is that USCDI could provide a bit of a bridge through its future versions by at least defining, you know, those vital few data elements that are really important to the most critical use cases, and by providing clearer definitions of the technical standards and clearer requirements for their use and exchange, that could help alleviate some of the confusion and potential pain related to a lack of standardization for all EHI. And I guess I just wanted to kind of open that to you, you know, for your perspective on that. Do you see value in a group like ours and HITECH making specific recommendations related to future USCDI versions, with the thought that will help to make that transition to all EHI?
So, couple thoughts. One, I always kind of talk about, you know, info blocking is kind of like the umbrella over all the providers, and then and other actors. Obviously, they're not just providers, there's developers of certified health IT and health information networks/exchanges. And then I see like the certification program is a way to get more, and particularly USCDI, which is required under the certification program, to get more data interoperable and out of systems. So that's one point. The other point is, USCDI has, I think, a lot of value. So it's a standard that's been adopted by the Secretary under Section 3004 of the Public Health Service Act. And there are other provisions that point to to use of standards under 3004, such as the two high-tech provisions, 13.111 and 13.112. So I think, you know, it will always have value in regards to standardizing and identifying data that's important for exchange to make, and for access to make, to be made available for. I just don't think it's ever going to be a one-to-one correlation with information blocking. And I think, again, a lot of that has to do with how broad the definition of healthcare provider is. There's so many providers that are covered that aren't either incentivized to adopt certain technology that would even, you know, be able to use the US CDI, for example, or process it, so to speak, in layman's terms. And I'm not sure that's going to change anytime in the near future. You know, you just think of, like I said, really most of like the long-term post-acute cares, as well as some of the behavioral health facilities that are covered. There's even certain ones that are like ambulatory surgical centers, which are covered, but also have various exceptions under the promoting interoperability program. So I'm not sure how again, a lot of value, and we as an agency, a lot of value in US CDI, and we think other agencies do as well, particularly within the department. So, you know, identifying the right data elements that should be in there, standardizing those data elements are going to have extreme value in the market in terms of making more data easily accessible and for exchange and use. I just don't know. I just wouldn't say it's a one-to-one with information blocking. I think it's definitely going to help certain entities make that data available that are covered under information blocking. And obviously that content and manner exception I mentioned earlier kind of shows our policy focus, right? We'll let the market decide how they want to exchange, which could be in a proprietary way, right? If they agree that the actor and whoever's requesting the data. But if they don't, you can see in that exception that our focus is trying to make that data available, use of certified health IT as agreed upon by the requester, then if not in a standardized way, and then ultimately still try to get the data out in a standard or in a machine-readable format with a way to interpret the data, again, agreed upon with the requester. So obviously our policy is to use standardized approaches to exchange of data, both in the program as an agency and undertones within the information blocking regulation. But I wouldn't say, you know, there's any type of one-to-one correlation between US CDI and particularly the EHI definition, other than, again, what I said in the outset, it was the easiest identifiable term or set of data that we could use from a limiting perspective in this first 18 months.
Great. I don't see any hands up, so I'm going to keep throwing some questions your way, but I do invite, there's Hans. Okay, sorry, Hans, go ahead.
Sorry, I was waiting for you to open it up, and that's why I didn't raise the hand yet. But you knew that I was going to ask a question here. And thanks, Mike, for the backdrop on that. And on the one hand, I clearly understand is that from an information blocking perspective, and the exceptions, you're starting out with the after October 22nd, 2022, is that it is going to be EHI, and therefore, in that sense, it does not have a direct relationship one-on-one. But I think the point that you're making around the other purposes around certification, and if you want to add without special effort, if you want to add interoperability in using standards, is that it's clearly creating the ability to help guide that, and as a result eases the path to not be triggered or being trapped into accidentally or otherwise into information blocking. So it has an important part there, at least as we understand it. And if that's so, that's where I think some of the comments are typically coming from. Is US CDI going to be the same in the end? Is it intended to cover EHI, designated record set? So I can appreciate that from an information blocking strictly an EHI perspective, it need not be. But for everything else, if we don't, we're going to have a problem. because at that point in time, we don't make it easier for everybody. So that's why I'm curious, is that from that perspective, is the intent of USCDI, as you understand it, meant to grow over time, most critical first, other ones second, to encompass EHI, designated record set, not to mean that everybody must support everything, particularly if certain providers or institutions, organizations don't have that electronic data, but that it is covering it so that those that do have electronic data, those are the standards according to which we want to operate, and therefore USCDI is going to grow into that level. What's your perspective on that, looking at it from that through that lens?
So that's a policy perspective. I don't necessarily disagree, but it isn't a stated policy of ONC yet. So, right, I have to be, you know, we have to be cognizant of that, you know, my leadership hasn't indicated that that is our intent with USCDI. I can talk to what the regulatory intent was, right, and that's what I'm going to continue to focus on. I think that's true. So your point about, like, clearly those entities that are going to use the USCDI as currently identified are going to have a more likely ability to meet requests for data, right, particularly the products that are certified. And it does lessen the use of, let's say, the infeasibility exception, for example, or the need for using that. So I think that is true. I can't confirm to you as a policy position of the agency that is our goal of USCDI. I do think it is understandable, and I don't think it goes beyond the lines of reason to assume that it will expand the USCDI, just looking back at various versions of what started out as the MU data set, what then became the common clinical data set, and then looking at some of the other data elements that are identified in the certification program, some without standardization, but some with, for example, some that we use for recording data under demographics for sexual orientation and gender identity, but also, like, in transition to care, there's data elements identified such as cognitive and functional status. So those are just, you know, I'm not saying those are the ones that are going in. Please don't read too much into that. I'm just pointing out there are clearly other data elements that may or may not eventually find their way into the standard. From a policy perspective, we have not indicated that as a policy goal of ONC is to expand the USCDI to it ultimately covers what it would be included in the designated record set. And I think you need, and just to talk a little bit about some of the data that's going to be, there will be some administrative data in the designated record set, right? So we haven't even broached that type of topic related to standardized data and whether it should be or not be in the USCDI. For now, we've focused on it being clinical data, right?
And considering, appreciate that, and considering that we are not only looking at EHRs, but also HIT in general that have EHI, is that it's very reasonable that data is in there. It's from that perspective. So I don't think we're going to have too strong of an argument there, but not every system might manage it, which we need to be aware of.
I mean, I definitely agree that USCDI is an enabler. Meeting and being certified to the USCDI is an enabler to providing access, exchange, and use, right, of EHI under information blocking and in electronic access, right, as well. So, which is, you know, obviously what we're striving for.
Thanks, Hans, for that question. Hey, Mike, I jumped ahead to a slide for later in our meeting, but we had a key question here, and I believe that we thought that you might be able to help us answer this. And in this, can you see the slides now, Mike?
Yeah, I can see the on deck
okay.
one. And I may, I'm going to look at it, but I may defer to Al because I'm a guest today, and I'm not quite sure your past meeting. So, but
Al actually missed our last meeting where this question came up, so you'll both be coming to this fresh. So the question came up. We're focusing here on the black text, including the strike through. This slide is some potential suggestions that we might be making through HITECH. But looking at the black text, which was and is the existing leveling criteria that ONC has used in looking at submissions that come through the OnDeck, we were trying to understand the specificity in the lower right-hand corner of the words pertains to majority of patients, providers, or events requiring its use. And the key question here is when we say events requiring its use, does that mean that even if it's a rare event, that the item would pertain to the majority of those rare events? Or if this is something that pertains to a small number of patients or providers, are we talking about something that the majority of the time that rare event occurs, that this data element would pertain? Or does this mean that really it's the majority of all healthcare events or the majority of all patients that would require this particular data class or element? And I know this is a big shift from where we were just discussing, and you may in fact not be the subject matter expert on these words, but this was a key question. And maybe Mark, if you wanted to add any specificity to the question, because I know you raised this initially before we asked Mike and Al to comment.
No, I think you've summarized it. If it's not clear to Mike or Al, I can take another stab, but I think you summarized
it. I mean, is it a question of what majority also modifies? Are we talking about kind of like the Oxford?
I can take this.
Sure.
I discussed with this was Matt earlier in the week.
Great.
So, Stephen, I think your question, the way that you framed your question is, I think, the perfect way to frame it to answer the question. Is it the majority of rare events, or is it the majority of all events? And events meaning it could be a particular care encounter. It could be something that requires the collection or use of a particular piece of data, whether that's it could be doing a pre-op appointment. It could be a preventive medicine visit. It could be a case reporting. It could be a place where you might want to do. You might be preparing a case report or a program report for various programs that you're participating in. I think in general that majority of events, so many events or majority of the events, refers to the broader community. There are many, many cases, particularly with submissions, the UNDEC submissions, where the majority of these rare events or rarer events require a particular data element. Okay, but the number of times in general, like per year, where that's needed is quite a bit smaller than other examples. I think that's a fair way to assess that. And so it's a balance between, do we address these specific very narrow use cases or rare events, as you said, or do we look at what the broader stakeholder community is going to need? Because as we add things to USCDI and as systems are updated to incorporate those new data elements, we are asking every system that does the update to add that data element, not just the ones that are going to be taken care of a specific narrow patient population. So I think that's generally how we look at it, is not just looking at the broad stakeholder community as far as events goes.
Okay, well, I think that's not what we wanted to hear. based on the conversation we had previously, because there's clearly a lot of folks who've been chiming in at these meetings who have an interest in addressing the needs of the data underserved, of addressing issues related to equity. And I think, you know, with a lens of there are communities that that do not represent either the majority of patients, the majority of providers, or the majority of events writ large across the healthcare spectrum that still have very important data needs. So I think this will end up being, if that's indeed the case, if we can take your word as gospel on this, I think that will end up being a focus of our next round of recommendations. Mike, do you have anything to chime in on that, or did I perhaps suggest appropriately that you're not the SME on this one?
You're correct. Al, I would defer to Al on this.
And Stephen, this is just as a, and I should say that this is our, this was our general approach for version two, for setting
right.
these levels, for setting these levels. And so the task at hand for the task force is, you know, to decide if those, you know, if you sustain those or recommend changes.
Got it. Okay, Mark, your hand's up.
Yeah, just to sort of crystallize what you said, your summary, Stephen, which I appreciate that in a different way. The people on the margins will always remain on the margins because they're in the minority, and that's troubling to me.
Thank you. I think that's it's a very good point, and I think we'll come back to that in crafting our recommendations. Any other questions for Mike or specifically Al or Mike Berry? Was there anything else that your team had hoped that Mike Lipinski would be sharing with our group to inform our work?
I didn't. The only thing that I was thinking about, and I is the focus on EPHI versus EHI, and I think what Mike addressed is there's that the EHI definition for info blocking purposes is centered around the protected health information that's. As opposed to other things like potentially administrative stuff that's not really EPHI or PHI as being part of the EHI definition. Is that right, Mike, or is that off?
Well, I mean, what do you mean by the administrative stuff? There is administrative stuff that is EPHI. That's going to be part of your designated record set. So I'm not quite sure. What you're trying to say, to be honest.
I think, well, maybe, I mean, are there examples of things that are in the designated record set that wouldn't be other than non-electronic?
There's
that wouldn't be
examples of things that would be in the designated record set that are not electronic? Yeah. I mean, that the designated record set is everything that you have access to under OCR. Some of it, you know, won't be EPHI. That's why we focused on EPHI. So it's going to have to be the data that's in electronic. So EPHI is like data in a electronic media, right? So, I think a lot of folks on here know this, but the designated record set is much broader than just EPHI. I mean, you can have the records that are in there that aren't in electronic format that a patient would have a right of access to under 164.5.24. So, but I don't think that's really relevant for this discussion. Does that make sense to others on the call? I think.
I think so. It sounds. Al, like you were differentiating in your mind EHI and EPHI, and in my mind that's not an important differentiation that I think about when I think about this work. But was there something else in there that you were trying to get at, Al?
No, I think Mike covered it. I mean, Mike, thank you for clarifying sort of.
Yeah, I mean, just so we're clear, and I think again, folks who have read the rule, and I'm not saying everybody has here, but you know, we obviously limited EHI in the beginning by saying it's just limited to EPHI and the designated record set. Our proposal was much broader than that, because the definition of health information in the Public Health Service Act is broader than that. So there was various limiting factors. A lot of it is, you know, for the policy reasons we laid out in the rule, including, like I said in early on, many of the actors covered or already covered entities under HIPAA or business associates under HIPAA, and therefore are familiar with EPHI, the designated record set, and so forth. And so it was from, you know, this is a new paradigm, information blocking. So I think we had to consider who was going to be covered and, you know, what made most sense at this time. But obviously that was our first limiting factor with the definition of EHI. They're not necessarily have to be one and the same. It was a policy choice to limit EHI to EPHI that's in the designated record set. And then obviously for this first 18 months, the data identified in the US CDI.
Thanks, Mike. Abby has a question.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Thanks, Leslie. My question is, given this administration's focus on equity and the recent learnings from the pandemic and the public health data that needs to move, do you see the ONC revisiting their policy decision that they just made around limiting to EPHI versus EHI? Do you see a revisiting or a conversation around that? Because there's a little bit of incongruence with the administration's focus and the narrowing. I'm not sure how we're going to bridge that.
Well, I guess I'd ask back to you, what data do you think that is being excluded that wouldn't be part of EPHI?
Well, let me put this out there, but I might sound like a fool because you may have a different interpretation of it. Things like transportation, food insecurity,
mm-hmm.
housing. I'm not sure if you consider that EPHI or EHI. I would have thought it was EHI and not EPHI.
No, I think that was helpful. I mean, obviously, for the EPHI, I wish I had my definition up right now. But again, if it's used for making decisions or it's included in the designated record set, then it's going to be in there just like price information if they put it in the designated record set. So if I assume that data is to you important, and I think it is from like to make decisions, right, to improve health outcome. And when you start talking about social determinants of health. So I think it can find its way into the definition of EPHI just as easily as it could to in the EHI definition.
Mike, would you say that it makes its way into EPHI when it is specific to an individual, their housing,
right, it has
their
to be transportation? Yeah, right. It has to be individually identifiable information. Not the HIPAA expert. I've been around enough of them, though, to remember some of the stuff, but I should just pull up the EPHI definition, honestly. So that we're all talking from the same thing.
So, Abby, I get the sense from your question that you're concerned that some of that FDOH data might be sort of left out in the cold and not be considered under the auspices of either info blocking or USCDI. Can you say any more about sort of what you're trying to avoid here?
Well, I'm just trying to learn and to understand what conversations have been had strategically at the ONC around closing that divide around equity. And I'm not an expert in how these definitions are structured or ratified.
Okay, so
I think I'm just coming from a place of curiosity. And maybe that's more of a strategic question around how do, related to social determinants of health, how do we make sure that that is as pertinent and relevant information when it is such a narrow set of data, going back to the to how you narrowed general it having to affect the whole population. I think that's part of it as well. So I think it's both of these things. Is it really going to be considered EPHI, and how do we make sure it's EPHI? Is that a good thing to make it EPHI? I'm not entirely sure it is. So I'm kind of going batting that around in my head. And then also this patient population, which is accounts for a significant component of the costs and the impacts to a lot of what's going on, I just am trying to figure out how that would fit into the thinking with the ONC and how do we bridge that gap. I think that's just what I'm trying to understand.
Sure. So I have the definitions up just so you understand how that works. And so the way it starts out under HIPAA is you have individually identifiable health information. Okay, and so that is a subset of health information, including demographic information, collected from an individual and is created or received by a healthcare provider, health plan employer, or healthcare clearinghouse and relates to the past, present, or future physical or mental health or condition of an individual, the provision of healthcare to an individual, or the past, present, or future payment for the provision of healthcare to an individual, and that identifies the individual or with respect to which there is a reasonable basis to believe the information can be used to identify the individual. So that's you start with that individual identifiable health information. Then you'd go to protected health information, and that essentially means individually identifiable health information. So that was the definition I just gave you. That is transmitted by electronic media, maintained in electronic media, or transmitted or maintained in any other form or medium. And then there's certain data that's not included in protected health information. Like, for example, if a person's been deceased for more than 50 years, and there's some other provisions. But nonetheless, then it's, protected is how it's transmitted. And then electronic protected health information is just that data that is transmitted by electronic media or maintained in electronic media. And so that is what then we say is EHI, and it's only the EPHI that's in the designated record set. I know that's a lot.
This is Leslie. So it seems that if we go back to that anchoring statement, that things that are used to be making decisions, and then you go into that definition, and it talks about to help identify an information, and I think you a person, and then you've got towards the end. That was somewhat alluded to demographic information. And SDOH comes into demographics. It's also part of the actual patient identity, who I am, what I feel, my situation. And so perhaps then to clarify this, a recommendation could be made that encourages that SDOH is underneath the banner of clinical decision making, and then it starts to flow across definitions. Rather than without that, you would have it's not expressly included or excluded because it could be defined differently by the user. It's art when you see it. So I think in these areas, it might be worthwhile for us to consider recommendations that allow SDOH to be included in these decision-making definitions. Is that
right? Not that it would have been excluded, but just making sure that it's explicitly included.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have your charge in front of me, but that sounds reasonable to me, and I just would want to point out that, like, clearly, I think you all know this, that ONC has always had a vested interest in this space. Like, we have one criterion about recording psychological behavior and social data that is standardized. We constantly look at this issue. Obviously, as you all pointed out as well, there are executive orders focusing on health equity. I think, you know, always helps. This is my position because, you know, from a regulatory perspective, studies are always very important in terms of, you know, pointing to evidence-based decision-making for us, in that if you can show that, you know, their studies show that data, certain data points, if we're included in the decision-making process for a patient, could have improved health outcomes, I think that's always relevant and important for consideration. And then, you know, what can ONC do in that space then to further that, you know, improvement of health outcomes?
Great. Any other questions for Mike in particular, or can we let him go and move on to the next part of our presentation? Seeing no more hands, Mike, thank you again for taking the time to join us. Really appreciate your sharing your expertise. We may come back to you in the future with more questions.
Always open for those questions. Happy to engage. And thanks for letting me join today. And good luck with the rest of today's meeting. See you all.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye.
All right. Let's go on to slide 8. There we go. Thank you. Just to reorient us to where we are in our process, focusing on tasks 2B and C at this point. But we have invited people to be thinking about task 2A at the same time. We did a lot of work early on in our process thinking about task 3, and we will be coming back to that. But right now, the focus really is on task 2, and particularly B and C. That is to say, looking at the evaluation criteria to assign levels to submitted data classes and elements, as well as the prioritization process used to select data elements for inclusion in the next draft version. So I think, Al, you were going to take us through the next few slides. Do I have that right? Kind of talking about the on-deck process, which is really more specific to task 2A, to make sure that people have a shared understanding of on-deck. And we have invited people to review the questions that are represented in the prep sheet, which is posted on the public web. But unless you've gone through and actually made a submission yourself, which some of us have and some of us haven't, you may not have seen the internal workings of OnDeck. So I think Al was just going to walk us through that so people had the inside experience of what that looks like.
Sure. You just want me to go through the slides and not you don't want me to do a live demo, do you?
I don't know that that's necessary. I think the screenshots do the trick, but if somebody has questions, we can do that.
So this is the entrance portal to the OnDeck submission system. And what I wanted to point out, I included in the chat box, the public chat box, the link to the prep sheet. And the reason I did that is because the prep sheet has additional sort of supporting or instructive language within the answer fields to help guide the kinds of information that we're looking for.
Just so that nobody's confused, I actually posted it in the public chat. You posted it in the private chat. So if you're looking for it in the public chat, it's under my name.
Oh, yeah, okay. Thanks, Stephen. You're right. I realized it was in the chat. So that's our current version of the prep sheet, which provides some instruction and supporting information for preparing preparing a submission. I should note that it is not the submission itself. We're not accepting copies of a completed prep sheet. It really is just so that people who need to do offline work, sometimes with committees or other their entire organization, to formulate their submissions. So that is a good guide, and the information that's in the prep sheet is also fair game for the task force to weigh in on when we talk about whether it's considered a 2A task or a 2B task, whichever. We're looking for input and improvements to that. And so in order to do a submission, which is the second button under how it works, you have to be a registered logged in user for our platform, which hosts both the Interoperability Standards Advisory and OnDeck. So once you log in, you can click on Start by Submissions, and then the additional information on this page is to show generally what we're doing with the information that you submitted. And so we'll make changes to this. I think we're gonna end up changing the submission due date to sometime in September. I don't know the exact date yet, but we'll change this page as needed. Next slide, please. So this is the first page of the submission system, and it actually requires you to put your name and your email, but the email address will not be public. Your organization and name will be published along with the submission, but not your email. We need the email to notify submitters of any action on the submission, including our publication review and need for additional information on it. We do have the feature to save a draft. So if you come back to the OnDeck system and click Start Your Submission again, you'll come to the last page that you completed in your last submission. So the save draft feature is also available. Next slide. This is where we begin to collect information about the data element itself, the name, and what you can do additional. If you look at the bottom, you can do multiple data elements for each data class. But if you want to submit multiple data elements across multiple data classes, you have to come back and start a new submission for the next data class. What we're looking for, some of this is pretty self-explanatory, and we want for you to be just as clear as you can be as far as the data element description. The data element description, or what will end up being the data element definition, is an important piece for us to do. And we've gotten some submissions where maybe it wasn't clear to us what the description was, but so we just get back with you. And Stephen has been a participant in this process where there was some clarity that we needed to get. And so we ended up going back and changing the data element description or data element definition to make it better or clearer for the public. If multiple data elements are requested, you can add that. And there's, as far as I know, there's no limit to the number of additional data elements in a single class that you can submit. The prep sheet has 7 or 6 fields for additional data elements, but that's just as an example. Next slide. This is the information that we ask about the particular use case or how this data element would be used, at least from the perspective of the submitter. It could be that there are multiple use cases, and it could be that those other use cases are sort of outside that knowledge of the submitter, but that's okay. We want you to describe the reasons why this is needed. And the particular situations in which the data is collected, accessed, or exchanged. And any additional information, including links and attachments, can be added to this. The last question is about the quadruple aim. We want you to at least take a stab at this. So far, we have not done a lot of data collection on the breakdown for the quadruple aim. But we felt the task force felt like it was important to collect it. Perhaps that's something that we could revisit as far as if it's that information should be captured within the use case description, but something that is currently required. Next slide. Just as a note, one of the things that could be helpful is if you have completed a prep sheet, including text. The prep sheet has fillable fields that can just be copy pasted, so you don't have to retype everything. And if you store it, if you fill it out and save it in electronic format, you can simply copy paste from these large fields in the prep sheet to the large fields in the on-deck system. This page is related to the maturity. So we're looking for several aspects of data maturity, the data element or the vocabulary maturity. Is the term already standard using standardized text? Various different vocabulary standards could be used. It's also possible that a data element is otherwise represented in an implementation guide, such as US Core Implementation Guide or the CCDA templates. And where that's appropriate, just make that indication about where it's used. It's not a requirement that's used in FHIR US Core or CCDA 2.1. Okay, I just want to, that's something that's pretty important for people to understand. There are situations, the SGOHCC IG is not the FHIR US Core, but it is an implementation guide, and that can be used as a reference. Public health implementation guides were also identified as implementation guidance, both FHIR and CCDA based, and those are where that additional information would be. Now we want to describe the use of the data element. So it's fine to standardize the use of it, have a published implementation guide, but if nobody or almost nobody is using it, it's less feasible for inclusion in USCDI. And so we ask about how extensively it is used, and in, whether that's in test or production environment. And then the third part of maturity is the exchange. So USCDI is the capture and exchange of health information, this core data set. And so we ask about whether or not it's exchanged with external organizations and to what extent it's captured. Now, these questions expand for additional information. If you say yes to these, and so the appropriate information about the extent of exchange can also be included. Next slide. The last part of this are these are challenges, and these, just to be clear, that the challenges that might be listed here are not going to go into the determination about leveling. In general, these are, the first one is potentially potentially affect the level, because there are some situations in which there's not broad consensus on how to use a particular data element or how to represent a data element. And my favorite example is smoking, because depending on your perspective for evaluating smoking, how to represent it is different. So if you're trying to provide smoking cessation education, the standardized terminology is different than if you're trying to calculate lung cancer risk, or cardiac risk is also different. So if you're not smoking in the last 30 days, your cardiac risk goes down, but not so much the lung cancer, for example. So if there's problems with consensus, that's a potential challenge to making it either a part of USCDI or having a specific applicable standard or value set to represent the data. And then the other challenge areas are involving any restrictions or fees associated with the use of the data element. Again, not a deal breaker, but something important to understand. Any specific privacy and security concern that's different than HIPAA data. The next one is a best guess as far as implementation burden, and that could be, is it going to take a lot of development? Is it going to require a lot of standards work, implementation guide work, or is it going to affect the workflow so significantly that it's difficult to implement at the provider level? So these are some ideas. These are some thoughts about that. And then any other thoughts that you might provide that could be helpful. And when we do the review, we sometimes go in and we make edits and changes to these fields, just to help guide us better when we make our decisions about coming up with the next draft of USCDI. Next. Can you go back one slide, please? The only thing I think I want to do is once you click, you there's an opportunity to review and edit your submissions before you submit. But there's also a requirement that you acknowledge that this is going to be a public submission and your name and your organization will be published and out there. And we may contact you for additional information. And then you'll get an email that says the submission has been completed, and you can go back to that submission and at least review it. If not, you can't edit it once you've submitted it, but you can get with us and make changes to it as needed. And we can get with you and look for additional information from you as a submitter. Okay, next slide. Back to you, Stephen.
Thanks so much, Al. I made a point in the chat, which I'll just put voice to, which is you made a comment that the identified challenges are not used to determine the level. And I must say, as I was going through this process and I got to that stage in the work, I did have a sense that, you know, gee, if I call out too many challenges, that might negatively impact my submission. Your statement just now was the first time I'd ever heard that. And I think that, you know, if that is indeed the case, that should be stated explicitly, probably at the top of that page on the website, as well as in the prep sheet. And maybe we'll capture that as a formal recommendation.
Okay.
Grace, you have your hand up?
Yeah. So I had a number of pieces of feedback on this process. So even if I took the time to complete the prep sheet, which I've tried, I, as a board certified patient advocate who can speak English, who has a PhD in biochemistry, I can't complete it. I don't have the technical expertise and all the knowledge to appropriately answer all of the different fields that are marked as required. So I see that as a barrier. I'll give you examples. Questions like use cases, number of stakeholders who capture support, access use, maturity. That's things that are more tangible to me now after working with the task force, but I'm still not able to answer a lot of these questions without reaching out to someone for help. Making mandatory fields like technical specifications. Again, I understand both sides of the coin, why these are essential pieces of information. I'm wondering if we're really going to make this inclusive and allow patients, their care partners, the general lay public to really be able to participate in this process. Would it be possible to add something like a drop-down at the very beginning, which identifies by stakeholder? And if someone self-identifies as a patient or general consumer, lay public, if we can simplify the form, and perhaps instead of all of the different technical pieces of information, if we would allow for the use case to be captured as a patient experience or a story where you can very briefly highlight the benefit or the harms associated with why you would want something in for consideration. You know, there's always this discussion about things being very self-explanatory, and sometimes when we take a step back and realize the intricacy of the work that we do and the privilege of the work we do, it's maybe self-explanatory to us, but not to people outside of this realm. And we may be excluding really important pieces of information that could really enhance the work that we're doing. I wanted to ask one other thing. And again, going from my experience and learning still about all the different nuances of the work that we do, is there a way that when you submit something, if something has been previously submitted, could you be pointed in the direction of that? Is there a way, let's say, is there a search function, or when you add your email, let's say I submitted something, but it's already been previously submitted. I've spent a few hours digging, looking for different things. I've reached out to task force members, and sure enough, something that I thought wasn't included really was deep in there. So that's another note. I'm just wondering, how can we sort of help connect the dots for someone who may not be super fluent in the long history of the work that the USCA CDI Task Force has done. That's the end of my feedback.
Grace, can I respond to that, Stephen? The two big things that I heard, Grace. One is, one of them is the sort of the need for more plain language descriptions of the questions, and I think that's a fairly straightforward fix. I'm a huge advocate of plain language, and I try my best, but of course I'm more on the technical side, but certainly sensitive to that. And the other part about being able to see if anything has been submitted already, we are working on an improved search function in the USCDI, and I think we're gonna go live with it. I think we're gonna go live with it any minute now, any day now. We're working on that, so you can search. The platform that hosts the USCDI is also the same platform that hosts the Interoperability Standards Advisory and our Standards Version Advancement process. And so the search function will work across all three of those platforms. But you can refine it to looking for a data element that's in USCDI. And I think that could begin to address, and I think I heard you say that you volunteered to test the search function for the new platform as soon as it's up and running, and I've got you on the list now. So those are two good points. And then your other points about drop-down menus, drop-down things and all that, that could really be helpful and really help it make it easier to use. You can, and I'll double check this, but you can search existing data elements and data classes by name from on deck. At least data classes, if not, I believe data elements are also searchable, but I don't think we have a drop-down menu for that.
And one other suggestion that Grace made was this notion, and Hans sort of chimed in the public chat, that depending on the submitter stakeholder group, that the requirements of the form might change. I'm not sure that I would personally support, removing questions or adding questions based on the identified stakeholder group, but one might consider whether or not all the same fields would be required. What I hear you saying, Grace, is that you have a sense of that the requirements of completing the field might be so daunting for some stakeholders that they would, abort their submission rather than trying to work through those. So I think the idea is that if someone self-identifies as a patient or a patient advocate, that perhaps we lower the bar, if you will, and provide additional support from ONC or whoever's doing the analysis to kind of step in and help fill in those blanks that might otherwise be more difficult to complete.
Stephen, if I may, I'm not sure exactly if it necessarily has to be to lower the bar. I do agree with you that not necessarily removing all the fields, but the asterisks for the required fields. But it's also another level. And when we talk about use cases, there's technical use cases for the exchange, but then there's the real world use cases, which technical people may not have any insight to, in the way that a person living and experiencing healthcare at the point of care may be able to shed light on. So I think it's just an additional level of perspective that maybe isn't in here. However, maybe that becomes an added field or question in this case. I'm sure there are people that on the task force that have had significant experiences within healthcare personally and professionally. And when we think about use cases, capturing the harm and benefit that can happen as a result of having a data element or class, I think is important to also capture it with respect to what's in the real world.
Great point. Mark, can I put you on hold? Because we got some commenters that hardly ever comment, and I want to make sure we give them some airtime.
Absolutely.
So Ken, it's so nice to see your hand up.
Hey. So I think this conversation reminds me of what is the purpose of this process and what is the purpose of USCDI? and this is something I've thought about and commented on off and on. It strikes me that the current process is really about what are the things that are pretty much ready to move to USCDI, where all the analysis has been done, you know, the technical hurdles have been all overcome, the standards have been developed, and we're ready to almost rubber stamp what the industry already knows is ready or pretty much ready. And if that is the explicit purpose of this process, I think it's okay. But if the purported purpose is we need to identify not what's ready to move forward in USCDI, but what do we need to move forward for USCDI and what do we need for interoperability that might not be there yet for improving patient care, you know, that kind of thing. I think this process has some issues there, right? Because it is geared towards people who can say, hey, I've already analyzed all the different standards. I've already analyzed the, you know, the 20 vendors that have implemented this. And, you know, I've done surveys of the EHR vendors, and this is what it currently states, all the outcome, and I've been engaged in this project. I think if my sense increasingly is that is, in fact, the purpose of USCDI and the on-deck process, and it's just kind of formalized that, saying, like, hey, we just tell us what's ready to move, and we'll move it forward. If, in fact, the idea is, let's not just, you know, rubber stamp the status quo. Let's identify things that need to move forward, to move this country forward. Then I think we need to review things like, you know, asking submitters, even sophisticated folks, like, you know, probably people on this committee, like, how do we know what every EHR vendor's implementations of these data elements are? Like, that's just not a pretty reasonable thing to, I think, ask. And to say, if you want to suggest something and for us to consider, you have to do that. So I would just bring this up as an opportunity to look at, like, what is the purpose? And if the initial state is we just don't have bandwidth to do anything other than to rubber stamp things that are ready, maybe we just explicitly state that and that's the purpose of OnDeck. So, you know, please do that. Maybe at a later phase, we'll be open to suggestions of things we can move forward. But I think that is worth thinking about, right? Because, you know, maybe that's all we can do because there's too much to do at this point. But I would think ONC as a coordinating body would ideally be suited to do things like, let's get, you know, folks input on what would be highly useful, even if you don't know what the standards are, even if you don't know, you know, what the EHR vendors have implemented, and we will now take it to the EHR vendors associations to see how they do it. We will take it to HL7 for the things that get a lot of, you know, thoughts that this would be important to say, like, hey, do you guys have standards? So anyway, that's my comment.
I think, Ken, when we met with Mickey and the leadership team at ONC, when Stephen and I did, we talked about this idea of the chicken and egg and the nest that we can incubate new information. And they were quite encouraging for using OnDeck for not just ready for prime time, but more aspirational areas. And I think our recommendations as we look to how to make it more user-friendly, how to offer up things that are not mature but high priority, I think they were quite open to those considerations. And I interrupted, and I see there's more comments, so forgive me for that.
let's go to Ricky. Yeah,
thanks. My comment was somewhat similar to Ken in that it may be helpful, and this kind of gets to some of Grace's comments. If there is a desire to expand the diversity of those who are commenting, then thinking sort of outside the box of other approaches might be useful in collecting that type of feedback. And obviously the feedback that we're collecting right now does require a certain amount of not just technical expertise, but understanding of how the regulatory process works and what type of feedback you can provide. And that just by its very nature does limit the type of individual who will even attempt to provide feedback. But I could see some value in making something as easy as, you know, opening a change.org petition or, you know, other forms of crowdsourcing where you can really appeal to patients themselves to try to hear what they might be interested in terms of what might need to come. And, you know, if you do that, obviously a lot of the things you'll get are things that might be available already, such as please give us our clinical notes. And, of course, those are things that we're quite familiar with. And others are going to say, well, I want my imaging data, for example. But I think that trying to think of ways that we could engage a broader set of stakeholders that may not be represented as well on this committee or that might be hard, you know, to accurately channel could be beneficial. I think it would require a very different process than what we currently have and a very different submission, you know, form than we currently have, but might be something that we could just think about as a way to expand the net of feedback and crowdsource in a more unique way.
Great, great comment, Ricky. So I want to let Mark and Hans get a word in. We're going to be going to public comment fairly soon. We've spent a lot more time on sort of on deck and what I'm thinking of as task 2A work than we might have planned. We have a number of slides regarding the material that's already been discussed, which I think may end up waiting until our subsequent meeting. But Mark, you want to go ahead?
Sure, thanks. Try to keep this short. So I really appreciate Grace's and Ken's and Ricky's comments. The thought occurred to me that we could even set up something where instead of having to fill out a form, you, for some who are less technically adept, you have an interview process. It's actually a conversation with somebody at ONC. I understand that might be more intensive, but it's the kind of thing in other areas where you actually are able to elicit the kind of information needed to complete a form for people for whom that's not their primary desire to complete the form. There was, in addition to sort of, I want to give an appreciation and an observation. When I did this back in October, I ran into some of the observations and questions that Grace commented on. Some of the ways I solved them was actually knowing who to reach out to at ONC. And the appreciation is folks there were, staff were really good about trying to help me get the form completed. But I happened to know how to reach out to somebody ahead of time. That was critical to my success. And I think we need to keep that piece in mind. If it's critical to other success, do we make it explicit or do we solve the problem so that's not needed? I'm not sure. It's definitely appreciation and an observation. Then two final observations. One, the comment that the timeline might be moved up to September 2021. If that's the case, I would strongly encourage getting that out to the public as soon as possible. I understand these, you know, you can't rush decisions, but the amount of time that it may take somebody to do the prep work to have something ready by whatever criteria, a difference of a month to 2 months could be big. So just thinking about when we get that information out to the public. And lastly, some of the criteria that we are considering recommending would necessitate some changes to the kinds of questions or the number of questions that are asked in the form. So just being aware of that. I think that's a more complicated version of the point that asterisk saying it's required might not be asterisk saying it's required anymore. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I think we're going to be pulling together these various suggestions about how to make this more accessible and inclusive, and including those in our high-tech comments. Hans, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Brief comment is that I completely agree that there needs to be different ways in which different stakeholders can provide input depending on their focus, area of expertise, etc. In one of those where the submitter is indicating that there are standards in the maturity level, there are two questions around that are at this point in time yes, no, unknown. But if the answer is yes, I think we need to ask for what is that standard? What is that implementation guide? Whether it's part of US Core or not, whether it's under development or not, That's going to be very helpful information to start to help understand maturity. Where is it on the path? Is it already there? Might it be eligible for a next regulatory round, but not for SFAP because it's a different standard? It's not yet referenced. That information is going to be very important for everybody that needs to develop against that to have a good understanding of it. So really would encourage that we ask not just yes, no, but what is it? If you think it's there.
Yeah, Hans, we do. Yeah. If you answer yes, it expands and asks for additional information.
Sorry, on the slide, it looked like it was just a yes, no, but that's great. And particularly beyond vocabulary.
Let's take this pause in the hand raising and go over to public comment if that's acceptable. And then if we have the time, I'd like to at least sort of, Leslie, have you run through the rest of the slides so people have a sense of the work that we've done and where we're going to come back next time.
Yep, that's great. Operator, can we open up the line for public comment?
Yes. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate the line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we poll for comments.
And while we're waiting for public comments, I'll also encourage any task force members who have anything they want to add to the discussion to go ahead and get your hand up so we can do that before we close.
There are no comments at this time.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And there are no hands up. So Leslie, do you want to sort of take us through slides 16 through 20 quickly just to sort of describe the work that you and others have done to get us here and then set us up for next week?
Sure. So what I did was attempt to take all the comments from these groups. If we can go back to the slide, there you go. And edited where I heard comments and make recommendations. So I'm just going to go through these quickly because we'd love to see specific things added. We do have some specific recommendations from Mark that we'll discuss next week. But in the meantime, we did request not only clarification in this stakeholders' impact as we got from Mike, but also to add the language that Abby indicated so that those on the margins don't stay on the margins, to Mark's point. Next slide, please. We also then defined on the data supporting underserved stakeholder groups under our draft priorities, a prioritization process, that these things could be medically underserved, data underserved, or populations of underserved, so that we were a little bit more broad in that definition. Next slide,
Leslie,
please.
I think we want that to say underserved and not undeserved. There's a little typo.
Good plan. So I'm dyslexic. I'll just tell you right off that. But that's funny. All right. Next slide, please. Nice catch. We also looked at the priority maturity ideas. We thought and discussed a semi-annual review by ONC of OnDeck and the current leveling for validation or modifications. And note the date of the review within the website so that people can see how current these things are. And this specific recommendation is that the OnDeck process and definitions in leveling are constantly reviewed for accuracy. And that at the version X or annual review, the USCDI also take a task-to-task looking at current leveling for validation or modification or making changes and recommendations to high TAC, that we provide guidance on the evolution from USCDI to EHI, that we ask ONC to provide that guidance. We heard that again today, and the role of the USCDI task force in those efforts. And ONC to provide guidance for the EHI release about standards, reuse, repurpose, creation, and the use of free text or narrative approaches to signal the industry as it prepares to meet EHI release. And this gets to sort of where is the low-hanging fruit and can it be used? Because getting
this all done in 18 months is as a challenge. So providing ONC's guidance or biases towards reuse, repurpose, and creation could be important. We're trying to gather Clem's ideas here as well as others. And then we talked about adopting both priority and maturity. Next slide, please. Also looking at a way to do some sort of visual recommendation or visual representation of these recommendations for rating. Go to the next slide, please. And this is certainly not a rocket science approach, but some way that we could say, well, wait a minute, this is current standards that really is level one, but we have a high priority areas, they all meet level two. How could we use this to depict the leveling? And this is just a very basic example, and we would love examples for visual representation. And next slide. I think that's it. So got those on time. We'd love to hear your comments. And I will also, in the notes, incorporate for next week some of the recommendations I heard today. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to be clear, you know, we're at time now, but we did want to at least get all of you a chance to see how we've been capturing this. As Leslie said, Mark did suggest some additional comments that came in last night that we will perhaps incorporate in the red lines for our discussion next week. At this point, we are going to continue on a weekly cycle. We have really just a couple more weeks to finalize the recommendations that we're going to bring back next month to the HITAC. So we're going to try to stay focused on turning these into really concrete recommendations. Leslie and I will work together to kind of wordsmith these so that we can go through them and capture specific recommendations next time to refine them. I guess we are at time, so we'll leave it there unless somebody has a brief comment to help close us out.
Just a quick question. Do you want to have us forward feedback to you directly or to Al, or how would you like to do
that? Yeah, I think to include Leslie, Al, Mike, and myself, and
okay.
we'll be happy to take that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Everyone have a wonderful day. Stay safe. Get vaccinated if you haven't yet, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks so much.
Hey, Al.
Bye.